I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. For decades, the Pullman Company was one of the most consistent employers of African-American workers. Pullman porters worked long hours, performed many menial duties, and faced terrible abuse from racist passengers. On the other hand, they were entrusted with authority and gained access to a world of privilege that was rare for African-Americans at the time. In his new book, Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class, Larry Tye looks back on this generally neglected chapter of African-American history and finds new resonance. The book is published by Henry Holt, and Mr. Tye is a former reporter for the Boston Globe, author of two previous books, most recently Homelands. It gives me great pleasure to welcome him to my show, and this doesn't seem to follow from the previous books, Homelands and The Father of Spin.
Sure. What it shares with those books is, like every journalist and author, you're always looking for the perfect little story that is a lens into a bigger story. And I think this very human personal story about the Pullman Porters is a wonderful lens into 100 years of relations between the races in America.
And it begins with George Pullman. When did he start his company?
He got it going in 1867, just after the Civil War ended. And he had done something revolutionary. He had thought that rather than just sitting up on the long trip across country, that if he could get a comfortable way for people to be able to sleep, that they'd be willing to pay him twice the price of a normal plane ticket. So he imported the finest craftsmen.
The train ticket.
He imported the finest craftsmen from all across the world to design the most elegant imaginable sleeping car. It had chandeliers. It had wonderful wood siding. And it had very comfortable berths. And all he was missing was the perfect servant to take care of these passengers going across country.
And from the start, did he hire African Americans?
He did. He hired only African Americans, and he hired only freed slaves.
And only from the South, or at least mostly from the South. He found them more desirable than blacks from the North.
Right. He had the sense that they were somehow more compliant, and that was where most of the freed slaves were. And what he actually was looking for, in the words of one porter, was the blackest men with the whitest smiles.
So there was an element of racism in all of this?
There was an element of entrepreneurship as well as racism. He was looking for people he could pay as little as possible, and he paid the porters next to nothing. He was looking for people that he could work as many hours as possible, and he worked these porters up to 400 hours a month. And most importantly, he was looking for the perfect servant who would do anything that a passenger required on a long trip across country, and who better than a freed slave?
So he was exploiting these men every way he could.
Well, there was actually a contradiction. On the one hand, he was exploiting them any way he could. On the other hand, he turned out to be the largest employer of African Americans in America and maybe in the world.
What was life like for them? Did they have any comforts at all?
They had very few comforts. To give you sort of one instance of what life was like on the Pullman train, they were guaranteed by contract 3 to 4 hours sleeping a night.
Where did they sleep?
Well, the idea of getting by on 3 to 4 hours a night is something extraordinary to me and you, I assume. Mm. And where they slept was critical. They slept in the smoking room, the men's bathroom, behind a very thin curtain on a ratty old couch. And if any man came in during the night and wanted to use the facilities, wanted to have a smoke, wanted to play cards, wanted to talk, those 3 to 4 hours turned into 1 or 2 hours or nothing.
And they had some pretty menial jobs to fulfill.
They were everything from janitor to chambermaid. They were doctor. They were law enforcement officer. They were basically the rulers of the sleeping car, which meant doing everything that a passenger asked.
A lot of it is what was considered women's work at the time.
It was
cleaning, sewing, looking at the children.
Absolutely. Which was interesting because when the porters got home, they were so tired of doing what they had been would have been disparaged as women's work that they very seldom helped their wives make a bed or clean or do anything else that they were expert at.
How much did their families and communities know about what they were doing?
They knew an extraordinary amount of the good things that the porters did. When the porters came home, they came back with great stories. They were the only blacks of that era. And that era means the 1800s through about the mid-1900s, who got the chance to see America. And they came back with great stories, what life was like in New York or Chicago or L.A., what was going on in terms of blues or jazz in small towns across the South. Great stories.
Well, how much time did they have in these cities if they were working 400 hours a month?
Not much, but enough to come back with great stories. And some of the stories were things that they actually saw. Many were things that they picked up during their working hours on the train.
And as you point out in the book, Pullman porters were the first black men many white people came into direct contact with.
Yes. Can I tell you a quick story about that that sort of encapsulates what the porter looked like in the eyes of much of white America? And the story goes back to 1918 in a small town that your listeners may be familiar with called Freeport, Maine. And back then, every day, these poor kids who lived in Freeport, Maine, as soon as they were old enough to toss a baseball or pick up a bat, they would go out next to the town hall every day and play baseball. And there were no blacks back then in Freeport, Maine, and only a handful in the entire state. And the kids were so poor that they had one baseball, and when the cover would get knocked off of the ball, they take it down to the local auto supply store to have it patched back on. In the winter, they paint the ball yellow so they could see it in the snow. One day, the kids are out there playing, and a kid named Hank Sewell hits a towering shot up over second base. And as this ball is descending to the ground, a Pullman train is pulling through the outfield, and a porter is standing out on the observation deck, and he catches the baseball. Now, to these kids who have never seen a black man, that was magic, and for the first 2 minutes of it, this porter, when he caught the ball, was magic. He very quickly turned into evil as he continued on to Halifax with their one baseball. What is extraordinary is that 2 weeks later, the same train pulled through again, and the kids were standing out there playing, and the porter was on board and tossed them a baseball. And this baseball had the signatures of all of these guys on it, including a guy named George Herman Babe Ruth. It was the 1918 Boston Red Sox, which any baseball fan out there knows is the last time the Red Sox won the World Series. The kids cherished that ball forever. Today it would be worth about $1 million. And I tell this story because in the eyes of white America again, the Pullman porter presented the only image they knew of a black man. And to these kids, it was mysterious and it was magical. But what it wasn't was it was a one-dimensional image, the same way it was to many passengers. They never thought to ask, do you have kids of your own? Where do you live? It was the image of a servant, but not of a human being.
And sometimes, despite the fact that these men were really very nice, obviously, at least in their dealings with others, they received abuse from the passengers.
Lots of abuse. And the easiest way to look at that is just to think about the names that they were called. They were very often called boy. They were called the N-word. And most cutting to them, they were called George. And they were called George because of an insidious tradition passed on from slave days where the slave was named after the slave master, and they were thought of as George Pullman slaves, and they hated that.
My guest is Larry Tye, T-Y-E. His book, Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. It is published by Henry Holt. And this is WNYC, celebrating 80 years of service. We are New York Public Radio, 93.9 AM 820. Well, Pullman porters were familiar to people who didn't ride the trains as well because of movies and the radio. What kind of image did they give them?
Generally a step and fetch it image, the same image that I was mentioning that the white world had of the black porter. It was a one-dimensional image. It was of a man who sort of mattered more because he was a servant and part of the furniture, and it was always as a backdrop.
And yet they did like at least one of the movies that had a porter, and that was the movie version of Eugene O'Neill's famous play, The Emperor Jones. The movie version starred Paul Robeson. Is that because the porter went on to become an emperor?
Actually, it was probably less because he became an emperor and more because Paul Robeson was such a wonderful, heroic, dashing character, and the idea that was a Pullman porter they loved.
These people actually became fairly worldly, didn't they? You mentioned their travels around, but also they were getting to, I suspect that the people who were hired were more likely people who would appreciate what they were going through.
Yes, they became quite worldly because they saw America, but more because they learned what one dining car guy called the three L's. They looked, they listened, and they learned when they were in the train. They picked up the reading material their passengers left behind, newspapers, magazines, books, and they devoured that. They picked up things like stock tips, and they made killings, many of them, in the stock market. And most important, they picked up the critical lesson of how important education was to ensure that their kids and grandkids could do better than they did.
So I guess I shouldn't be surprised that Thurgood Marshall was the son of a Pullman porter.
Thurgood Marshall, when he was in college, worked in the train himself, and he was the son of a porter. We could go on and name lots of names. Willie Brown, the recently retired mayor of San Francisco, son of a Pullman porter. Tom Bradley, first African-American mayor of a big city, L.A., son of a Pullman porter. From Roy Wilkins to Elaine Jones, jazz musicians, scientists, doctors, lawyers, disproportionately children and grandchildren of Pullman porters. It was quite extraordinary considering there were only at their height 12,000 porters in America.
Well, thinking about the situation for these porters, where they did have to be rather obeisant, the developing an image of Uncle Tom's, was this something that they were very conscious of and a reason that their children went on to achieve in other ways?
It was. Their children understood that these were very proud men who had suffered a fair bit of abuse when they were in the train, and they understood that they were sort of living the dreams of their fathers. The porters really took offense. They knew what a critical role they had played and their leaders had played in civil rights, and they took offense when their union leader, A. Philip Randolph, was declared by a leading black militant in the 1970s to be Uncle Tom number two in America.
Yeah, well, he had really played an important role in the union movement in this country. And a great deal of your book focuses on the disputes between the Pullman Company and the Porters Union, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. What was the union demanding from the Pullman Company?
It wanted three critical things. It wanted higher pay, it wanted shorter hours, and maybe most important of all, it wanted respect for the porters. And one of the ways that it embodied this drive for respect is after they got a union, one of the first symbolic gestures that the union insisted on was that every porter be given a name badge, basically saying, I have a real name, my name is not George.
You write that the Brotherhood's eventual victory was an accomplishment for blacks everywhere. In a symbolic way?
In a symbolic way, in that it was the first successful black trade union, and the idea that these porters could take on one of the most anti-union companies in America, the Pullman Company, that was wonderfully symbolic. The symbolism was added to by the fact that the guy who ran the Pullman Company when the porters won their union was Abe Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln. And there was a sense, the porters used to say that Abe Lincoln freed the slaves and his son re-enslaved them with industrial slavery.
Well, was Lincoln's son aware of what was going on here, the irony of this whole situation?
He was aware of what was going on in terms of beating back efforts for the porters to form a union. Whether he was aware of the irony, I'm not sure.
Well, what about Philip Randolph? Had he worked as a porter as well?
He hadn't, and they actually brought him in. He had a quite stunning record of failure. He had tried to organize elevator operators and failed, tried to organize head waiters and waiters in restaurants and failed. Everything he had done, he had failed at, but he was smart, he was eloquent, and he was not a Pullman porter, which meant that the Pullman Company couldn't fire him, and that was one of the key attributes in this 12-year effort that the porters brought him in to lead, and it took him 12 years almost to the day to finally get a union.
But he succeeded, and he became a major figure in the civil rights movement. So why was he labeled a Tom later?
Because people have short memories, and he started his work in the civil rights movement way back in the 1930s when he was still working as the head of the Union of Pullman Porters, and the idea that in the 70s this gray-haired guy could still be a major figure in civil rights was something that, unfortunately, leaders in that time just didn't have a sense of history. I think if Martin King was the father of civil rights in America, A. Philip Randolph was a grandfather.
And you credit another porter, Edgar D. Nixon, with getting Martin Luther King Jr. involved in the Montgomery bus boycott.
Can I tell a real short story on that? The year is 1955. All your listeners know that Rosa Parks was arrested for not going to the back of the bus. What maybe most people don't know is that when she was arrested, she called two people down to bail her out, her husband and a Pullman porter named Edgar D. Nixon, who happened to run the office that she worked for, the local office of the NAACP and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Nixon gets on the phone the next morning and calls 19 ministers to ask them to come to a meeting to talk about a bus boycott. The third minister he calls is Martin King. King's young, naive. He says, call me back. Nixon calls the other ministers, calls him back, and says, Reverend King, will you come to our meeting? King says, I'll come. Nixon says, that's great, because I've invited 18 other ministers to come to your church at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Nixon was the one who was a logical leader to run the bus boycott, as King himself said. He was out on the Pullman trains too much of the time to do it. I tell that story because it's a metaphor for what the Pullman porters did behind the scenes from the earliest days of civil rights.
And yet, in most of the histories of the civil rights movement, they get a couple of footnotes at best.
They did. That's why I wrote my book.
And is that because they were still seen as an embarrassment on some level, their subservient jobs, making them an embarrassment?
Exactly. Partly because they were an embarrassment, partly because they were doing it behind the scenes, partly because nobody knew that they were donating their union halls and their money to help underwrite the civil rights movement when it had no places to meet or money.
When did the Pullman Company go out of business finally?
In 1968, 101 years after it started.
Now, that's pretty long time, considering the fact that by 1968, most people were flying across the country.
Flying or driving, yes. So they survived for a long time. They ultimately died. And the sad thing is that when I was going out and looking for porters to interview, most of them are gone as well. The ones who are alive today are in their 90s, and the one that I just left in Chicago is 104.
Are there any sleeping cars in any trains when you travel across Canada, for example?
Elegant ones in Canada. Amtrak, less elegant. There are sleeping cars today, but anybody who rode in the Pullman era wouldn't recognize them as part of the same enterprise.
And they don't have, obviously, all black porters.
No, they have the wonderful thing, and probably the porters would have been delighted to know that there are today women porters, porters of every color, but more importantly to the porters of the old era, porters today can become conductors or anything else.
But had it remained all black until 1968?
Until 1968.
The Pullman Company kept that as a matter of policy?
It was all black with the exception of a couple dozen Filipino porters that George Pullman and his successors brought in to try to threaten the porters who were trying to form a union, saying, if you keep this up, you will lose your monopoly, your all-black monopoly on the job.
But didn't the union actually try to keep non-black porters out of the jobs?
Actually, the union welcomed the Filipino porters, and there was just never a question with the company hiring non-blacks, just as there was no question that no black could rise to be a conductor or anything above.
Larry Tye has written a book called Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. It is published by Henry Holton. I want to thank you so much for being with us today on the show.
Terrific. And could I say that I'll be tomorrow with the New York Public Library, the Mid-Manhattan branch at 6:30, right across the street from the main library.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
I'm sorry.